Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Oh, the only limits there are the ones that you set for yourself. So stop saying that the sky is the limit. The sky is no longer the limit. If you feel that you can go beyond the sky, then do it. And remember, as we become adults, we take on these roles. And the one thing that we forget is our imagination. Our imagination can take us places far beyond that we can ever imagine. So remember to keep strengthening that.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports Podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. Happy holidays, y'all. This week, we talked to Prince Daniels, former NFL player and author of the book Mindfulness for the Ultimate Athlete, Mastering the Balance Between Power and Peace. Should be a fascinating conversation. Also, a special treat this week, we are talking to the coach, Kevin McNutt. And our choice words are going to be about me and coach. Breaking it down, chopping it up on a whole host of angles and topics. We also have the Just Stand Up and Just Sit Down awards and more. But first, let's talk to Prince Daniels. First and foremost, Prince Daniels, for those of us to have a framework, how would you define mindfulness?
I would define mindfulness as, just to make it very simple, just being aware of the things that are going on around you, how you speak to yourself. You know, there's always internal chatter inside our mind. And so we just have to be mindful of what we're saying to ourselves, what external things are coming into us that's allowing us to be aware of the present moment, and not judging the moment, but allowing your thoughts to just pass like water flowing down a stream.
Wow. How did you come across this philosophy and why did it speak to you?
I came across this philosophy after I was discharged from the NFL, playing with the Baltimore Ravens. I had three incredible years there, but I was prematurely discharged. And afterwards, you come down off of this high and now you're a civilian. You don't get the same type of treatment. You're not regaled anymore. And I had a self-identity crisis. Fell into a depression, and I needed something to lean upon. And the best thing for me to do was to look within myself and find something that that was hidden for a very long time. And so I had an opportunity to go to a monastery, and I got some direction while I was there, and I was able to discover, you know, the jewel that was inside of me, and that's how I was able to discover.
I got to say, Prince, you have to explain part of that a little more. Like, how did you stumble upon a monastery?
Well, I have two uncles who were always looking to improve themselves, and I just followed in their footsteps. And it was I had an opportunity to spend time at a monastery in the United States and really find myself. So I would say I was fortunate enough to have two uncles that were into mindfulness and meditation. And so they told me about it, and I always wanted to visit. And so I thought the time was ripe whenever I was in the NFL. I started when I was in the NFL because I wanted to improve my game. But little did I know, after my time was over, spending time at the monastery was great for my life.
Wow, that's amazing. If you could talk a little bit, if you don't mind, because I think it helps for folks to understand. Can you talk about the incredible like scope of your career, like from college to the pros, the roller coaster, the ups and downs, like where you went to college, how you performed at college, and then making it in the pros?
Most definitely. So started off from Houston, Texas, A-Leaf, Southwest A-Leaf. A lot of people know about that. And I graduated from high school. Didn't do well on the ACT, SAT. So I had a lot of scholarship offers from big schools. And during the signing day, I didn't sign with anyone. And so I had to figure out what was my next step. And really, I did not know. I was just wishing upon a star. And for the first year, one of the coaches from Georgia Tech, they came to recruit at our school. He was coming to recruit someone else. My coach told him about me. He saw one play of me. And after that, invited me to Georgia Tech. Went there. I talked to the coaches. They told me if I do good on and off the field, they can see about getting me a scholarship. It did not happen like that. So one, let me say this. I got accepted to Georgia Tech with my grades because I passed the ACT, SAT afterwards. And I had a 3.4, 3.5 GPA in high school. So I got accepted into Georgia Tech. And then from there, had an opportunity to play on the football team, be a walk-on. Through hard work and attrition based upon my teammates, I was able to land a starting job at Georgia Tech from the number 7th running back to the first string running back. And I broke NCAA records in Georgia Tech history for the leading rusher at Georgia Tech. Well, the 5th leading rusher at Georgia Tech history. And from there, I got drafted to the Baltimore Ravens. 2006, the 4th round, 132nd pick. And I struggled there as well. It seems like everywhere I struggled, I struggled on all levels in my playing career. But I always overcame, whether it was in high school, whether it was in college, and in the NFL. But the only thing in the NFL, it was a business. And I would say emotionally, my emotional intelligence wasn't as high as I needed it to be. You know, I needed to be more resilient. I needed to understand that it was more of a business, and I needed to have like a mentor guide me and give me the mindset so I can understand how I should approach this.
When you say it's more of a business, does that mean that there's less kind of a connection between players, less camaraderie, more ruthless? Like, what are the big differences between the college and the pro atmosphere?
Yes, it's definitely less camaraderie. It's no handholding. It's time to become a man. You know, you're thrusted into this world, and you have to pick up on some skills very quickly and be very crafty on making sure that you know how to present yourself as a professional. Yes, it's really cutthroat until you make the 53-man roster. Until then, it's dog eat dog. Who's going to have a position on the team? In college, everyone has a position on the team, even the walk-ons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here in the NFL, it's completely different. You know, every year, there's new competition coming in, faster, stronger, better, smarter, and you have to figure out where you are in these individuals. So you need to try to compare yourself to these individuals or compare yourself to yourself, which allows you to separate yourself from everyone else. But the difference is the speed of the game and also just understanding like the game of football. In college, you get a chance to understand this and understand that, but it's coupled with schoolwork. And now in the NFL, it's more football, 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 football. Okay, here's your life. Football, football, football.
Mm. Now, you were with the Ravens. I mean, they're generally regarded as this kind of model franchise from the top down. What was your experience like being a Raven?
Oh, man, it was amazing. I would not want to go anywhere else. Everything from top to bottom, the top office was really good. The owner, Steve Bisciotti, Ozzie Newsome, Eric DaCosta, they were all incredible. You know, the head coach, all the players. It was just when you would walk into the Ravens facility, there was a type of aura of like greatness. You walk in and you hold your head up high because you knew that you were around greatness. You had Ray Lewis, Bart Scott, Adalius Thomas, Ed Reed, Chris McAllister, Samari Rowe, Jonathan Ogden, you name it, Terrell Suggs. It was just so many great individuals in one locker room. And you had an opportunity to learn from everyone, which allowed for you to elevate your game if you really understood what you had in front of you. You know, at the time, I had the number one defense in front of me. So my mindset switched to I get an opportunity to go against the number one defense every day. So if I get an opportunity to do that in practice, when it comes to the game, everything is going to look effortless or feel effortless for me. But to others, it's going to look extraordinary. So, you know, I pride myself on being able to play with those guys and show up every day and play to my best ability.
You know, now that you've walked us through all that, I want to revisit something you touched on earlier in the interview, which is how mindfulness helped you when your career ended. So you're off the Ravens at this point.
Right.
And it's just, did it feel like you were stepping through a portal or something and just had an entirely different identity once you weren't playing in the NFL?
Most definitely. When you leave the game not on your own terms, it's very difficult because there was this void that was created. See, I had on my life timeline, I had football was in there. And so once football was taken out without me actually marking it out of my timeline, it created a void in me. And I was struggling with understanding who I was. And I felt that I was ostracized. And it was just in my head. It was a figment of my imagination, but I just felt that way. I didn't know who to talk to. I just came off of IR, and I've been away for some time. Never really showed my face at the facility because I sequestered myself and was trying to figure out who I was. I was before I was released from the Ravens, so that pretty much. Carried over into not being an NFL player. And it was more so identifying, like, who am I? I was embarrassed, really, because, you know, I didn't want to show my face. And I didn't want people to ask me, like, what happened? You know, is everything okay? Like, you know, I saw you get drafted, and I knew you was about to play, but what happened? So I didn't want to face that, and I didn't want to answer any of those questions. And for me, it was just trying to figure out how do you maintain that level of energy. You know, football is a violent sport. So when you're let go on someone else's terms, you're still left with this cantankerous energy. Mm-hmm. And you don't know where to direct it. And if you don't have the right guidance, the right assistance, the right help, you can definitely take yourself in the wrong direction or you know, find something mischievous to get into, because it's easy to do the wrong thing, but it's difficult to maintain to do the right thing. And so I had to figure things out had to remind myself, okay, what am I doing here? What's my purpose? How do I find my purpose? Right now I'm struggling. Who am I? And once I started asking myself those questions, eventually the answer started to reveal itself, but it took some time.
It's a really interesting phrase you use, cantankerous energy. Is that like just like you're addicted to the kind of physical contact that comes with playing in the NFL and practicing for the NFL, the collisions, the physical release? Is that what you're talking about?
Correct. Yes. It's a platform where you're able to release any type of anger that you have pent up inside you, any type of frustration, where you get an opportunity to display your strength. And so you become addicted to that because, one, you have to do it day in and day out. You have to go out there some days and you're in practice and your body is aching and you're like, oh, man, I don't want to be out here. And you get into practice and somebody hits you. And it's just like, oh, now I have to turn it on. And so you have to go from having maybe a docile type of energy and attitude to, you know, like, let's go. You have to get ready. And so that cantankerous energy, it's in you. So it becomes a habitual thing where now you don't have the same platform to release any of that energy. And so now you have to figure out how to channel that energy into something else that's constructive. And it's kind of difficult to just be at peace and calm after you just finished playing and you still have this residual energy. So you have to figure out what's going to allow you to either maintain that adrenaline rush and so it can exhaust itself, or as I mentioned before, redirect that energy that you have.
Right on. Speaking of redirecting energy, your book is called Mindfulness for the Ultimate Athlete, Mastering the Balance Between Power and Peace. So talk to me about that title. What does that mean?
Nice. So Mindfulness for the Ultimate Athlete. So when I was coming up with the title, I wanted to teach athletes the things that I've learned when I went to the monastery, about being able to tap into your inner greatness, your inner genius. And I wanted to use meditation, but that's like not politically correct, and I didn't want to turn off anybody, because what I realized is that what I was doing seemed it had a negative connotation to it. And it seemed very foreign for a lot of people. But I did not care about the title. It was just more so just learning about the skill and learning how to, you know, move forward in life. So Mindfulness for the Ultimate Athlete, the mindfulness part came from just making sure athletes understand there's a level of your mind that you have not tapped into. So you need to become more mindful of it. And being ultimate is like the pinnacle of what an athlete wants to reach. The mastering the balance between your power and peace. When we talk about power, you know, when we think about athletes, we think about power and something that we're familiar with. But too much power is very destructive. And when we think about peace, you know, as I mentioned, you know, spending time at a monastery with monks, that's what you think about. Think about peace. But too much peace is too passive and submissive. And so when you learn how to master the balance between the two, then you find that neutral space where it seems like the zone exists. But not just the zone existing, you live into the zone and you feel it, you become it. And so I've been able to tap into the zone on the football field, but also at the monastery. And so I decided it was perfect for me to merge these two things so I can teach players like how to tap into the zone, get into it, understand that you're in the zone, and know how to get back to the zone repeatedly.
Now, is something like this, you said you wanted something for athletes. You know, Calvin Johnson, the great Megatron, he wrote the intro to the book. Is how do you define an ultimate athlete? I mean, do you think this philosophy is really just for the Megatrons of this world?
No, not at all. It's a mindset. How do I define it? Well, there's no one set ultimate athlete. I think we are all athletes in this game of life. But when it comes to the ultimate athlete, it's more so all of the pieces that come together for this individual, whether they're small, tall, big, medium size, it doesn't matter. It's about their mindset. It's about their heart. It's about their ability to tap into something that's far beyond them, tap into their inner greatness. And yes, we all know that Megatron was an ultimate athlete. We've all had an opportunity to witness that. But it doesn't matter your size, you know, because a Calvin Johnson comes every once in a while. But it's about being able to go beyond the levels of competition. And when you realize the ultimate athlete form is when you're in competition with yourself. Mm-hmm. And you're not competing against anyone. Like, you almost go out there as, I'm competing against humans. Oh, okay, let's go.
Exactly. No, that's, and if it could help Megatron, you know, you could have that attitude of it'll help me too.
Right.
Do you know of any coaches or teams that are trying to embrace this philosophy? Like trying to use it as a way to integrate it with a collective sports mindset?
Yes. So the Denver Broncos running back coach and offensive coordinator, Curtis Mockins, he's definitely wrote a blurb about the book, and he's also implemented it in his room, the running back's room, and his offense. So he gets behind the book, and the Ravens, they're definitely embracing this as well. I have an opportunity to work with them, and everyone is slowly jumping on the bandwagon, but they are because they realize that this helps far beyond the game. And so it's also helping them set their players up for success after the game. Mm-hmm. But during the game, it's allowing you to open your mind up and tap into, as I mentioned, that inner greatness, or I like to call it energy, not the E-N-E-R-G-Y, but the I-N-N-E-R, capital G. And so I think, you know, I think these coaches and these teams are seeing that these players need so much more to really tap into who they are and be able to continue to play at this high level. So the Broncos and the Ravens.
I mean, and those are two franchises that are always, you know, sort of seen as being a step ahead of the rest of the game in terms of trying, you know, new techniques and, you know, building a more cohesive team unit. So,
most definitely. And if any other teams are out there, please give me a call.
Exactly. Well, you've been so generous with your time. Is there anything else you want to add about the philosophy, about how it can help folks, and about how it's important to be able to meld, you know, the athletic world and the real world, and as a way it can be like a helpful bridge between those two places?
Yes. The main thing is learn about who you are and what you can do. I think what we, when we look at ourselves, we don't see ourselves as individuals. We just kind of see ourselves operating in this body and like, oh, I can do this, I can do that. But man, look what that person can do. And look what that person can do. But it seems like it's like more of a braggadocious type of thing whenever you look at yourself, or more egotistical, but it's not. Because when you start studying yourself, which is human nature is observation of the self. We observe things. That's how we learn. And so when you start looking within yourself, you start seeing there are other things that you could do to make yourself or to improve your overall being. And when I wrote this from my spirit, from my heart, to teach people that the only limits that you set, or the only limits there are, is the ones that you set for yourself. So stop saying that the sky is the limit. The sky is no longer the limit. If you feel that you can go beyond this, the sky, then do it. And remember, as we become adults, we take on these roles. And the one thing that we forget is our imagination. Our imagination can take us places far beyond that we can ever imagine. So remember to keep strengthening that, because it will allow you to, as I mentioned before, tap into your energy, your inner greatness. And so for me, I just want that. I want everyone to be able to realize that there's something far beyond us, and that you have a superpower inside of you that you have not tapped into. So make sure that you do that. And also keep loving yourself, you know, and keep a smile on your face. And when you have an opportunity to work hard, work hard, give it all you got, and learn, keep learning and cultivating, mastering the balance between your power and your peace.
Wow. Well, very well put. Before you go, Prince Daniels, I always ask folks this question on the show, especially folks who write books, like, so what kind of music do you listen to, and what kind of music maybe helped you through the process of putting this book together?
Oh man, so a lot of meditation music, and some international music. I really like Putayama, and yeah. You know, yeah, definitely some hip hop music, some pop music. It's a, you know, I have a variety of all the music that I listen to. Man, now you have me thinking about all the music that I have. I listen to everything, man. Anything with a nice beat and a nice groove, and some great vocals or some great lyrics. It just gets me in the mood, man. I resonate with the artist, because I want to feel exactly how they made the song. So, you know, when I get an opportunity to close my eyes and listen to that, I vibe with it. I can imagine exactly how they made this song and what they were feeling. And so when that happens, it's basically I'm tapping into my inner spirit to connect with their spirit and see what they did, to what type of energy they use to make this song, to make a masterpiece. And that inspires me to go and create my masterpiece myself. And you know, as I tell people, the word inspiration derives from two words, that's in and that's spirit. So we all have an inner spirit. So when you can use your in spirit to inspire someone, then you are making a difference in their life. And so that is the reason why I wrote this book. I use my spirit to write this book so I can inspire other spiritual beings.
Right on. Well, yo, Prince Daniels, thank you so much, man. This is a great story. It's a really impressive book. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Dave. Man, this is a great opportunity. I appreciate you, man.
Oh, no doubt. Be well, sir.
You too, brother.
That was Prince Daniels, everybody. We'll be back right after this, after a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this, but first, a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation magazine. Okay, look, the need for independent journalism has never been more important, and The Nation brings it each and every week like they've been doing since 1865. I'm serious. This is what you gotta read. It's The Nation magazine. Go to thenation.com/subscribe, and please never forget that when you support The Nation magazine, you are also supporting the continued existence of this podcast. So please subscribe. Go to www.thenation.com/subscribe. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. We are back on the Edge of Sports podcast. Now, we are going to talk to a favorite and a friend of the show, Coach Kevin McNutt. Coach, how you doing, sir?
Wonderful, baby. It's holiday season. Holiday season. And I'm talking to my main man, Dave Zion.
Nice. Sounds good. So I know there's so much that we wanted to discuss, but first and foremost, an issue that we haven't touched yet on this show that I wanted to get your thoughts about, and that's Keyontae Johnson.
Yes, sir.
In seeing this young man, this star player from Florida, he had COVID over the summer, I believe it was. And he goes down on the court, and it's really touch and go about whether or not he's even going to recover. He's apparently making contact. He Skyped with this team. His family says he's talking, but it just raises this whole issue of the NCAA and COVID in ways that's just like bright light neon.
No question, buddy. No question. Dave, I was watching the game live around this time last Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
They go to a timeout. They come out of the timeout in a TV timeout. It's one on one of the ESPN channels. Come out of timeout. Then they go right back to commercial because they said that we have another injury. They come back. Then they're saying that, okay, Johnson's being carted off. No details, nothing. But it hit me so hard. I'm a lot older than you. I'm 112.
Yes.
It took me right back to Hank Gathers, Royal of Marymount, 1990. That's what it seemed like. Okay. Gathers, for those that don't know, was a star player for Royal of Marymount. He collapsed early in the season. And then, you know, they treated him and he said he wanted to play. That's what he does. In their Big West tournament, it might not have been Big West, but in their conference tournament, he collapsed again and died. Royal of Merriman went on to the tournament, had a nice run, Bo Kimble out of Philadelphia, and so forth and so on. But that's what it hit me with. Now, this is where I follow up on what you just said. The game should have been canceled at that point on. They should have just said, hey, no game the rest of the way. If you saw this, day, the players were crying. They were uncontrollably crying on the Florida team. Some of the Florida State players were in shock. They were praying, all of this. Mike White, the white coach of Florida, let's play. Now, I didn't know the particulars of this, but it was reported in Bleacher Report that Leonard Hamilton, Florida State's coach, who is black, asked Mike White, you want to do this? You know, we don't have to continue. Mike White said, yes. Then at halftime, Mike White goes, again, Leonard Hamilton says, hey, man, we don't have to finish this. We can stop right here. He says, I asked my players, and they said they wanted to play. I don't know if that's true, but it's immaterial. You are the coach. Sometimes the decision, you got to make the decision for the young men.
Exactly.
They kids. I don't like saying kids. These are young men. And you need to make a decision and not play the rest of this ball game. They play. Now, the kid, and you can see from the moment, and this was, by the way, this was in the first timeout. So we're talking about 16 minutes of the first half. Only 4 minutes have been played when this happened. So you can see in the kids, they were double-minded, their spirit was gone, they were lifeless, and they went on to lose a game by 15, well, I think the final score was 12, but it was at 15, it was never in doubt. Okay. So I'm saying, how in the world do you play this? And then it just hit me, the stark reality of, and I already knew it, but this is flush, of black labor, white wealth of college athletics.
Mm-hmm.
You had the pandemic. We're playing in a pandemic we shouldn't be. And you have these games going on, and you have these kids, young men, that are playing this game, and they have nothing to do but play ball. There's no classes. There's nobody on campus where they have classes. They have to study for finals. but you're doing that online. So they are quarantined. All they have to do is play ball. Now, when you have COVID and it hits, you can't even play ball. You can't even practice. But this is what these guys are going through. No Thanksgiving with their family. No Christmas with their family. And Mike White says, hey, come on, just play. Sort of like the Lay's potato chip commercial. We'll make more. I mean, it just hit me flush. I'm so glad we're talking about this because I got filled with it because it was just the epitome of black labor, white wealth. Mm-hmm. So now, fast forward to this, Keontae goes into the hospital. They induce a coma. He's recovering. He's starting to come out of it. And then Florida, in their infinite wisdom, decides to cancel a game against North Florida on Wednesday. And then subsequently turn around and say they're canceling three other games that are coming up. They got to be non-conference. They're not SEC games. And I'm saying, why are you doing this now? You should have did this then. And AD gets out some statement saying, well, we're concerned about the emotional value of the kids. What? Well, we play this game on ESPN for the big dollars on Saturday while this guy's being wheeled out with nobody knows what's going on. Last thing I'll go on this, well, two things, but next to the last thing I want to mention about this, the announcers on ESPN, I thought they were negligent in their duties. They never said anything. They never showed any remorse or thought for the kids, the young men that are playing out the game. Never once did I hear them say, because I watched the game intently to see what was happening. No announcement was made until halftime, and they just said he's at the hospital, and no details, which I can understand. The announcers were saying, the game goes on, the kids are playing, and then when Mike White gets a technical, then the announcers say, well, you know, he's so heavy right now, he's got a heavy heart because his player was getting out of here, and it's a tragic thing. But not once did they say with the players, his teammates, his buddies, their comrades, he didn't say anything about the black athletes on the floor. So the parallels here just strike me. And I don't want to leave on all on this rant without telling you a positive of this thing. Thankfully, prayerfully, Johnson's on the mend. We don't know to what level where he's going to come back. He did a tweet yesterday where he thanked everybody, all the prayers that he's received and so forth. So it's all good. But I want to tell everybody within my voice, and everybody, including you, Dave Zirin, who's got a son that can ball, although he's just 12. But the scholarship thing is we got to get our scholarship. But parents need not celebrate and be derelict in dotting the I's and crossing the T's what the scholarship is about. You need to use that scholarship like they're using you. Get it. Get your degree. My daughter played at Georgetown. It would not have happened if it not for her athletic talent. So when you get these opportunities, don't celebrate and solely celebrate. It's a magnetism thing to get that. But stay focused on the task. Understand that if there's a business, you are a commodity. Get your degree. Get your degree. Get your degree. And I'm finished, Dave.
I'm really glad you went through all that. I mean, it's such an incredibly exploitative system.
Right.
And that really actually makes me angry, this idea of the coach saying, well, the players want to play, so they should play.
Because thank you.
It's like a coach is actually officially supposed to be a professor. They're a member of the faculty.
Come on. Member of the staff.
And can you imagine a bunch of students coming in and just saying like, yeah, well, we don't want to take the test today. And a professor being like, wow, didn't write that test. Well, I consider myself to be a player's coach as a professor. So, I mean, come on. This is pure unadulterated nonsense.
You're the man, Dave.
You got to call it out as such.
I can see somebody in your audience might say, well, wait a minute, why did you make this a black and white issue? Well, it is, because at the highest level of D1 athletics in football and basketball, it is the black athlete. Now, they may say that it's, the number is 65% of the teams are, but look, you got to take it a little bit deeper. Because in my first book that I wrote, I did a survey. And in basketball, your starters, your top five, your top six, seven players are mostly black. They're 80%, 90% black players. So when they say there's 60%, no, a lot of that at the end of the bench are friends of the program and guys that aren't going to play. So that's why, you know, so I'm trying to, when I say black labor, white wealth, that's what I'm talking about. But in and of itself, it's just a despicable thing for all the players and all the athletes that are out there now with this pandemic. 3,200 people died yesterday alone, and they're playing basketball for this hundreds of million dollars that are online for the NCAA tournament, which was lost last year, and they're definitely going to get this year.
Exactly. Come hell or high water.
Yes, sir.
And you know they wanted it last year, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And look, I'm about the biggest. Look, what the NBA is to you, college basketball is to me. And speaking of that, I got some Zion zingers for you on the NBA, which is kicking off next week.
Oh, well, perfect segue, sir. Throw them out at me.
Did you tell the folk what Zion zingers are all about?
Well, why don't you tell them what Zion zingers are all about?
Well, Dave and I go way back. We've had
way back.
Well, Dave had a show on Sirius Radio with my books. I interviewed, and Dave said, hey, you're pretty good. Why don't you come on back? And before we know it, I'm his sidekick on the show. So we started this thing where Zion Zingers, where I would hit Dave. I just asked Dave some questions. He doesn't know what I'm talking about. Mostly it's NBA. And then he just gives his answers to them. Sometimes they're tough questions. Sometimes they're softballs because, you know, I try to help Dave out, and I'm, you know, I got to feed him the rock. But anyway, you ready, Dave?
Yes.
This is a little different than our normal one. I'm going to do it in the ESPN 30-30 segment where they always ask you, what if I told you?
So,
you ready?
Ready.
What if I told you the Nets will finish in fourth place in the division and dysfunction will reign supreme, similar to the Tampa Bay Bucks in the NFL?
I would say that would not shock me at all. The East is stronger this year, deceptively stronger in many respects. I think if you're talking about teams that would be necessarily ahead of the Brooklyn Nets for all their pedigree, you can't sleep on the Bucks, who are going to be so much happier with Giannis Antetokounmpo. Mm-hmm. Love the new look 76ers with Doc. Doc Rivers. I think they've had an A+ off season.
Mm-hmm.
The Celtics are the Celtics. Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, 1 year older, looking mm-hmm. like they look. And then all of a sudden, hey, what do you know? Brooklyn Nets are fourth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I didn't even talk about some of the other teams that are giving me some excitement. So that would
Miami. Did you mention Miami?
I didn't mention Miami.
Yeah.
No. I think Miami is actually going to have a come down year because I think that was a little bit fluky in the bubble.
Huh.
All of that being said, I think the idea of Brooklyn coming in fourth to me behind, and yes, I'll say it again, Milwaukee, Boston, Philadelphia, that's the way I see this rumble going into this year.
I mean, there's some bad vibes coming out of there, Dave. I mean, you know, Kyrie's talking this and then talking about we're coached by committee and Nash is one of the best ever to do it, but this is his first
go around. Yeah, I mean, how can you not get deja vu of Jason Kidd in his first go around? Brooklyn, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. Dave, what if I told you that James Harden will be traded to a team other than the Nets or 76ers?
I'd be legitimately surprised. I mean, the 76ers
really? Make
the most sense. Ben Simmons makes the most sense as a piece for James Harden if it's going to get done. But, you know, I just interviewed Chucky Brown and Mario Elie.
Yes, sir.
And they seem pretty set on the idea that James Harden's going to do what he's going to do, but the Houston Rockets are going to do what they want to do also.
Okay. So you think he will, okay. That's cool. I got another Rockets question.
Most sense. That's what I got to say.
Right. Another Rockets question. What if I told you that John Wall and DeMarcus Cousins will start together only 25% of the Rockets games due to recurring injuries?
Oh, it would depress me very much. Mm-hmm. I love those guys in college. I actually did the NBA rookie transition program and did a talk when they were rookies coming in. Mm-hmm. So I saw them all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at age 19, getting into this league with all the potential in the world. So I'd like the idea of them having a nice second act.
Right.
So let's try to make that happen, please.
Okay. All right. But do you think that, you know, I mean, they're coming off Wall hasn't played in 2 years with a knee and then Achilles, and just DeMarcus hasn't been able to stay healthy.
Yeah, no, that's true. DeMarcus is the one I'm more worried about, honestly, because Wall's been, all my intelligence tells me that Wall has been pushing it really hard. And yes, it's been 23 months since he's seen a court, but at the same time, you know, he's doing what he's doing.
You know, I'm passing on that comment where you say all your intelligence. That's an oxymoron. but I move on.
you
threw me that softball, Dave. Come on.
By all my intelligence, I mean all of my secret spies.
I knew you were going there, brother.
I certainly don't mean those coming out of my brain.
I love you, boy. Right. What if I told you, this is one you're going to like. What if I told you the Wizards backcourt of Beal and Westbrook will combine to average over 52 points a game?
I would say that's my expectation. I love the way Russell Westbrook has apparently been looking in practice. He's apparently changed the energy in the entire building. And also, you know, here's an interesting statistic. For all the talk about Russell Westbrook being this kind of amazing ball hog, look at the people that he's played with and how well they have done scoring-wise. I mean, Kevin Durant, James Harden, I mean, even people like that he played with in his 1 year where he didn't have either of those guys with him in Oklahoma. I mean, he was setting people up to be better players. I think Russell Westbrook is underrated as a guard who makes his teammates better. And I actually feel a great deal of confidence that him and Beal are going to just be absolutely like peas and carrots.
You eat peas and carrots, Dave?
Oh, yeah. Peas and carrots.
So do I.
Eat delicious.
Of that 52, okay, they're gonna go over 52 points. What's their averages to get that 52?
Yeah. No, I'm going to go 27 and 20. Beal 27, Westbrook 25.
Really? Okay. And triple-double for Westbrook, or maybe say, what is it, eight assists, seven rebounds?
It'll be like 8 rebounds, 10 assists. I mean, 25 points. It'll be a very sweet year for Russell Westbrook. And, you know, there's the old expression, past is prologue. Uh-huh. And the man is a 9-time All-NBA player. I feel very confident.
Okay. And the Wizards will be?
The 6th seed.
Woo! Dave Zirin coming strong. Really?
There you go.
Okay, brother. Okay.
This is how we do it.
Okay. This one I have to ask, but I have to put a little editorial comment before I hit you with it. I'm a Giannis Antetokounmpo fan, and you know I am, Dave, because I was on him, I guess, maybe a second or third year in the league when he did the fivesome, where he led the team in scoring, rebounding, assists, block shots and steals. Is that all of them? Scoring, rebounding, assists, block shots and steals. He led the Bucks in all 5. And I was preaching his case there. Watch this guy. He's going to be the man. He signed the largest contract this week. But what if I told you that Anthony Davis is a better all-around talent than Giannis?
I'd say Anthony Davis has to amp up his killer quotient by about 15% before I'm willing to have that discussion.
Got you. There's two knocks. He doesn't play. Well, nobody plays as hard as Giannis. I mean, that's one of the things about it. He just plays. If Westbrook plays hard, so does Giannis. They're tag team in that. And Davis has to ramp it up. And the other thing, which he did this year for the most part, is that he got to stay out of the repair shop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a history of that. And oddly enough, it was Giannis who got hurt and then missed the Mr. Playoffs while in the bubble. Well, you know, he didn't advance in the playoffs because of injury. But Dave, as much as I dig Giannis, man, and I watched Anthony Davis for the first time, because this is the first time he was into the playoffs and not on bottom feeder over there in New Orleans, is that Davis can do it, man. Davis can play defense. I saw Davis out there on the perimeter. I saw him taking, you know, blocking shots in the hole. I saw Davis hitting threes much better than Giannis can. I saw Davis doing something I have yet to see Giannis, and it drives me crazy. You know, Davis can face up, one dribble and up. I have yet to see Giannis do that. I've seen Giannis stand up and take a three. I've seen Giannis go to the basket nightly. He leads the league and points in the paint, but I have not seen him look at a guy, go left or right, and one dribble and up. And so Davis' game seems a lot more polished, and I'm not sure I'm seeing outside of, like you just said, the effort. And Giannis is in the open floor with the ball in his hands. He's one of the best, which gets him an MVP, but doesn't get him advancing in the playoffs.
Oh, the question of who's more talented, I mean, up and down, I mean, is not difficult at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's Mr. Anthony Davis. But I mm-hmm. think Giannis has an instinct to his game that is so unteachable.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, my goodness, his journey is one of legend.
Yes, sir.
And it's going to be very interesting to see what he does to follow up this year.
Okay. And same question with the
Wizards. What if he just keeps getting better? Giannis is 26.
Yep. So, what is Davis?
Better?
What is Davis? Dave, I don't know. Davis has got to be in the same range, right?
Anthony Davis is 27 years old.
27, yeah. So, and he's coming off of a title. Now, again, he got with LeBron. I guess Giannis, he was with LeBron, get a title too. They're both there. I didn't mention the 55% from the free throw line. And that's a pet peeve of mine that just drives me crazy, especially as much as he gets fouled and as physical as he plays. So anyway, just before I go to the next one, where is their playoff seat?
Milwaukee. Wait, which team?
Milwaukee's.
Oh, Milwaukee number one.
Number one seed in the East.
Yes.
Going how much farther than that?
Oh, I think they are definitely conference finals. Let me just leave it there for now.
which leads to one of my other questions. A tough one, but I got to address it. I mean, it just got to address it. What if I told you that COVID will interrupt 25% of the NBA schedule?
I would say I'd be very surprised.
Really?
The numbers have looked very good. I think there's been one positive test so far. I think the players learned something in the bubble. I think everybody knows the stakes. I think nobody wants to go back to the bubble, and they're the only league that sort of has that hanging over them. That I think that's the way of the walk right there.
Okay. Okay. Good. I hope so, Dave. I hope so. But okay. You know, this is good. It's taken down 25% of the college schedule so far. And I'm not even talking about, the football, Power Five football. Here's the last one that is, you may not want to answer because you didn't on the Bucks, but I got to throw it out there because it looks to me that they've improved on every level. What if I told you the Lakers are so strong that they will have a regular season winning percentage over 80 and will cruise through the playoffs on the way to a second straight NBA title?
I'm a buyer on that. I mean, like, it's another year together. It's Marc Gasol. I mean,
yes.
Center. I mean, what an upgrade that is.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Etan Thomas, who I do a radio show with on WPFW, he disagrees with me about that. He mm-hmm. thinks that the Dwight Howards and JaVale McGee's were uniquely suited for this team. But I mean, I'm a believer in Marc Gasol, and I'm a believer in this Lakers team. So put him down 80%, 72 games. What is that? That's about 55, 58 victories somewhere in there.
Somewhere in there, yeah. And so, again, you know, LeBron may sit out a good portion of those just because the season ended about 24 hours ago. But if he plays, I don't see that. So let me ask, Avery Bradley back?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's no sleep on him. He's a very good player, one of the top defensive guards in the league. I've always liked his game. And who was the other guard they signed, Dave? Didn't they sign another guard, free agency?
Well, they re-signed Kentavious Caldwell-Pope.
Right, right. Because I know they replaced Rondo.
They got this kid, Talen Tucker, who's just looking, and Dennis Schroeder.
Yes, who was. That's what Dennis. I was trying to think of that. I drew a blank on his name. So I think they've improved on so many levels around LeBron. I just don't see... the Clippers sixth man of the year that came over there.
Yeah, Montrezl Harrell.
How did that happen?
I don't know. what an indictment of the Clippers, though, you got to say.
Yep. Look like that.
Man like that go.
Yes. So anyway, that's, you're pretty good. You're ready. I can tell you're ready.
I'm locked and loaded.
Well, that's about all I got. You were on rapid fire today.
No, we're ready to rumble. Coach.
Yes, sir.
It's awesome. Thanks so much for joining us on the Edge of Sports podcast. Please, I know podcasting's a little new for you, but please come back again.
I'm on demand, Dave. All you got to do is holler. I'll be there for you, buddy.
Sounds good.
All right. Happy holidays, my friend.
You as well, sir.
All right. Bye now.
Peace.
We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there. This is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it, but we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast.
And now it's time for the part of the show we call Just Stand Up and Just Sit Your Ass Down. The Just Stand Up Award this week has got to go to the activists who fought to change the Cleveland Indians name and the people who fought racism in 2020, because it's all connected. This past summer saw the largest and most widespread anti-racist demonstrations in the history of the United States. Touching all 50 states, these demos sent an unmistakable message to corporations, the film industry, the art community, and of course the world of sport. The message was that there is a young generation in this country that is more diverse and less tolerant of intolerance. There is, especially in the sports world, a cutthroat competition for Generation Y dollars, as social media, streaming services, and esports have emerged as economic competitors to the legacy sports of football, basketball, and particularly baseball, which has the oldest fan base of them all. Major League Baseball is now on the hunt for ways to not age out of existence. Already, Major League Baseball is constantly critiqued for its unwritten rules against exuberance, bat flipping, and what the younger generation refers to as fun. Racist branding isn't the way to connect, and its marketeers know it. But in addition to the issues of the economic concerns of the sports world, as well as the anti-racist demonstrations from the summer, we have to be aware that young Native activists have put the question of mascotting at the heart of struggles for land rights and economic justice. Their argument, which is backed by the American Psychiatric Association, is that mascotting hurts Native kids. They make the case that if a human being can be mascotted by the dominant society, it becomes that much easier to ignore their actual real-life oppression. When you couple that with pressure from sponsors who don't want to be associated with 19th century branding, it means that it was only a matter of time before the Indians' name was going to go the way of the horse and buggy. And fans of the Kansas City Chiefs and Chicago Blackhawks, I mean, you're right now saying, well, that happened to them, but it's not going to happen to us. I mean, people saying that, I mean, ask Dan Snyder. Them some famous ass words, and you just don't know which way the wind is blowing. It's blowing towards justice. The Sit Your Ass Down Award this week,
Sit Your Ass Down,
goes to Brian Kelly, the host of the Notre Dame Fighting Irish. If you haven't been paying attention to what's been happening in college football, I don't blame you. It's an oppressive COVID cesspool of injustice and decay. Not exactly something I want to do on a Saturday afternoon. But for those of you who have been paying attention, you're probably aware that Brian Kelly just said that he would boycott the college football playoffs, boycott them. His entire team wouldn't go to the Rose Bowl if it means that parents of players can't be there. This is what Kelly said. I'm not sure we'll play in the playoffs if the parents can't be there. Why would we play if you can't have family at the game? If you can't have families at bowl games, why would you go to a game where your families can't be a part of it? What is the sense of playing a game in an area of the country where nobody can be a part of it? Of course, talking about the Rose Bowl, which is in California, whose COVID restrictions would mean that families can't be there because there are no ICU beds left in California. But that is not really Brian Kelly's concern. His concern is for his players being able to celebrate this such beautiful moment with their families. Now, Here's the issue. And if I'm wrong about this, you know me. I'll be on my podcast saying I was wrong. But the idea that Brian Kelly would actually forego the college football playoffs because his players want their families there is the emptiest threat since, you kids, stop that or I'm going to turn this car around and go home. This is complete and total grandstanding by Brian Kelly. Notre Dame, if they're eligible to do so, will be in that college football playoffs. And, I mean, I just am so tired of the pompous caterwauling by these college coaches who are making millions of dollars a year and try to act pro-player with statements like this when they're really objectively pro-COVID. So, Brian Kelly, sit your ass down.
Sit your ass down!
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thank you so much to our guests. Thank you so much to the producer of this podcast, David Tigaboo. For everybody out there listening, please mask up. Be safe this holiday season. It's dangerous out there. Stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.